I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Edgar Allan Poe, born in Boston in 1809, orphaned at age two, was an ugly duckling who morphed, strangely, into a black sheep in literary Boston, when all he wanted as a writer, he said, was to be as mysterious as a cat. So many reversals marked the life and the afterlife of this great Gothic storyteller. Poe invented the modern detective and detective story, the very model of Sherlock Holmes, but nobody has ever solved the mystery of Poe's own death at 40 in Baltimore. "I became insane," Poe once wrote, "with long intervals of horrible sanity." So many Poe lines cry out to be read aloud. We'll hear some of the best, but then there's the argument about his real merit, his all-time standing. In France, the great Baudelaire made a habit of offering his first morning prayer to God, the second to Poe. The American verdict has been all over the place, though there are those, as we'll hear, who say that Poe is as good as our best, up there with Melville and Twain, Hawthorne, Faulkner, James. We'll begin with Paul Lewis of Boston College, hard charger in the Poe cult that finally got a splendid statue on a corner downtown near Poe's birthplace. Christina Bevilacqua is here from the Providence Athenaeum, another incandescent Poe zone. And also the novelist Matthew Pearl of the Dante Club and the Poe Shadow, which was an attempt in fiction to discover the truth of Poe's death. First, here is what the people say. Snapping selfies in front of the new statue at the official Poe Square across Boylston Street from Boston Common.
Oh, I know who he is.
Yes, did you learn any in school?
Yeah. The Raven.
Yep, that's the one I know.
The Raven and Annabelle.
Well, isn't that the really long one?
Once upon a midnight dreary, while I pondered weak and weary.
Nevermore, nevermore.
Quote the Raven, nevermore.
Public school did work.
Boy, he used to be maybe like somebody called Baudelaire in France. Somebody very closed.
Very dark.
Yes.
I love the dark stuff.
The one about the pendulum.
Pit and the pendulum. Such a good ending. Such evil.
My favorite Poe story is Descent into the Maelstrom. The language is so rich, and it's so descriptive, and it's so incredibly frightening.
The one with the beating heart, or the eye, or whatever it was.
I'm a big fan of the
Telltale Heart when I was younger, definitely. It's a spooky story when you're reading it at night by yourself in the bed. Yeah.
There's always something sadly romantic about his writing, too. It's just what I really appreciate about it.
We're big fans of the
Cask of Amontillado.
It's chilling. It was just a very eerie tale. Very creepy.
The idea of being buried alive.
Oh, I really like the black cat. Perfect for Halloween.
He's one of the greatest poets that ever lived.
Amazing what people know, Paul Lewis. You represent a sort of fighting faith in Poe, and you're winning, seems to me. What's it all about?
So Poe teachers and scholars like to say that the general public has a very limited understanding of Poe, that they think of him as the master of the macabre because they associate him with those few stories which we just heard people mentioning. I come at it from a slightly different point of view. It's true that Poe's work is more diverse than most people think, that he wrote a novel, that he wrote about seashells, that he did political satires and social satires as well as his more famous works. But I guess the point I'd want to make at the outset is that all of this work, or much of it, comes out of a concern with mystery. So in a way, it's better to think of him as the master of mystery, and that he developed in his early childhood trauma, losing both his parents, but especially his mother, who died a lingering death of tuberculosis down in Richmond before he was 3 years old. Mm. And I think that experience, as Freudian critics have said, gave him a lifetime of thinking about dying women as a beautiful subject. He once said the most poetical subject in the world is the death of a beautiful woman, and you can see it in Lenore and The Raven and Madeline Usher and Ligeia and many others. So I think it's true that in terms of content, his trauma as a child, just as the psychoanalytic critics say, led to that subject. But I think a more profound influence is that it gave him a sense of the instability of the world, the unknowableness of life, and so in all of the different work that he does, or in much of it, he's probing at that. Like, where do you go from mystery? Do you go to humor because you want to sort of make light of it? Do you go to horror because it's overwhelming and dangerous? Do you go to problem solving? So you can see that Dupin, the detective, comes out of the instinct to solve the mystery, right? But lots of his other characters try to solve the mystery. What is this raven? What is the meaning of the raven? What's going on in the House of Usher? And that these characters do much less well than Dupin. They could use Dupin, right? Like one of their instincts is to be a problem solver, to figure it out, to be the rational detective. But over and over again, Poe shows these characters failing to do the thing that Dupin succeeds at. So I guess where I'd start is this sort of nexus of response to the unknowableness of life and how it generates all of these different moods, cognitive processes, and that adds a kind of fascination to almost any of these works.
Paul Lewis, this is absolutely fascinating to me. The unknowability of life, and he's confronting it, something's coming clear. He's confronting it without dogma, with a great deal of, courage, with a kind of openness and readiness.
And it's unusual in his culture because most writers are working from some set core of beliefs, and they're using fiction and they're using poetry as a way of expressing and even arguing for those beliefs. Poe was famously opposed to that. He was anti-didactic. He called it the heresy of the didactic, thinking of especially Boston writers like Emerson or Longfellow. And, you know, I think his anti-didacticism comes out of this belief of, first of all, aesthetic belief about literature, but also this sense of, well, how can you have a set core of beliefs that you want to devote your writing to when the world resists understanding?
This is just dawning on me that it wasn't book sales or ego or just nastiness that drove his fight with the Transcendentalists. It was something serious at stake. We'll come back to that. First, though, I just want to say that new statue of Poe is just fine.
Thank you.
As good in its way as those bronze ducklings from Make Way for Ducklings in the Public Garden. A marvelous lady at the Poe Foundation right there told us she's 92 years old, and she's been waiting a long time for what you've just done.
The standing joke is George Washington slept in every town and Poe drank in every town. Unfortunately, it's true.
I'm Patricia Bartavia at 160 Boylston Street, Boston, Mass. The Poe Foundation, which is what we are. And we got the statue. You know, this is interesting. When we started the foundation, we thought, well, he's pretty much local, you know, the state and so forth. People from all over the world know Poe. China, everywhere. I said, well, how do you know? Oh, it's in our language. We've read him. We had him in school. I said, what? India? Egypt? China? Oh, yes. I thought, well, educate me a little. That's why we felt the statue was important. Because the tourists come here and they wanted some way to have their picture taken with something, and there he is, so they can. And after we had the dedication, there was about 1,000 people there then. It's a bronze. It was cast in a number of pieces. It was made right here in Boston. We're very excited about it. All the effort was well worth it.
Thank you, Pat Bartavian. Thank you, Paul Lewis. Carry on about the Transcendentalists, this battle with Emerson especially, I suppose, Longfellow at an ego level, but even the idea of Transcendentalism, their cheerfulness, maybe their social improvement, maybe their anti-slavery and their abolitionism. He didn't think that way at all.
No, he didn't. Poe would not have passed political correctness muster in 2014. He had a lot of opinions that were, you know, it would seem really dated, which is not surprising considering how long it's been. He died in 1849, so he didn't really get to hear the abolitionist argument as it was fully developed later on. I don't know that it would have persuaded him. He grew up in the South for the most part. I suppose his argument with the Transcendentalists goes way beyond the sort of insult war that he engaged in when he came to Boston to lecture in 1845. And it was both about what they thought and about the fact that they were willing to develop their ideas in poetry and in fiction, where he thought it didn't belong. But as for what they thought, yes, well, for them, nature is this gateway to ultimate understanding, enlightenment, wisdom. Go live out at a cabin on Walden Pond for a few years, and you get a sense of the symbolic nature of the world and how it represents the mind of God and all of that. he didn't know anything about Thoreau, clearly. He died before, long before.
No, he missed a lot of good action, including Leaves of Grass and Moby Dick and some great Emerson essays. But what he was scathing about the way they puffed each other.
Oh.
And all this self-puffing. They were so contented out there in Concord. But again, what was the core of the almost cosmological, religious idea that bugged him so?
Well, you know, honestly, he does talk about the so-called poetry of the so-called transcendentalists, and he talks about Emerson as someone who was a mystic for mysticism's sake. So I think he was accusing specifically Emerson of being deliberately obscure and therefore earning a reputation for wisdom that was perhaps undeserved. I think a lot of my students share that perception when they make their way through some of Emerson's essays.
I got to say, no. I mean, he's never obscure to me. He's dreamy. He's he is relentlessly optimistic and maybe full of himself, but...
Well, Christopher Lydon, you are a Frogpondian.
Yeah, that was this damning word. I am a bit of a Frogpondian, maybe. What did that mean to him?
Well, so, I mean, I think it has to do more with the purposes of fiction and poetry. And he's a Frogpondian in the sense that he's always croaking. He's always thinking that the writers associated with Boston and coming out of here were overly pious, took themselves too seriously, were always advocating for some kind of cause or worldview.
He might have been right in certain ways. There's a grandeur about that group, though, that's not to be dismissed by Edgar Allan Poe or anybody else. We're going to take a break, but first, Poe's midnight melodramas and those chiseled sentences are irresistible for actors, sort of karaoke bait for all kinds of comers, as you can find on YouTube. Here is one marvel named Tom O'Bedlam reading the start of a short story called The Mask of the Red Death. It was written in 1842. It sounds today like a prevision of Ebola in West Africa in 2014. Listen.
The Red Death had long devastated the country. No pestilence had ever been so fatal or so hideous. Blood was its avatar and its seal, the redness and the horror of blood. There were sharp pains and sudden dizziness, and then profuse bleeding at the pores with dissolution. And the whole seizure, progress, and determination of the disease were but the incidents of half an hour.
I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source, unearthing Edgar Allan Poe.
Then I heard it. It might have been a hand, a clock, but no, louder and still louder. They must hear it, yet they sit and talk and talk. They must. Of course they do. They know. They do. They're torturing me, watching me, letting it beat so that I...
Stop it! Stop it, you devils! Yes, yes, I did it! It's there, under the floor! Oh, stop it! It is the beating of his hideous heart!
That was the actor James Mason reading the very end of The Telltale Heart. We're getting to know Edgar Allan Poe in a fresh way with Boston College professor Paul Lewis and friends. We're all under the spell of this Boston-born original and master in the forms of dark romance, horror, crime, and detection, Edgar Allan Poe. Born in 1809 in a theater suitcase, 6 years after Ralph Waldo Emerson, at the far opposite end, almost out the door of the Boston Literary Hall of Fame, then and till recently. Poe died in Baltimore in 1849. We still don't know just how. Matthew Pearl is a novelist who lives in Cambridge, author of The Dante Club. He's learned a lot from Poe, and he's put a lot of time, study, and imagination into learning more about Poe. Christine Bevilacqua, also in our studio, is keeper of the Literary Flame in Providence, Rhode Island. She's a learned librarian and program director at the Providence Athenaeum, halfway up the hill from the train station. Christina, put Providence on Poe's map, but then the man and why he fascinates you as a man with a story.
Well, he comes to Providence sort of at his he's at the last bits of his life. His wife has died the year before. It's 1848. And most of his schemes have come to ruin. He comes to Providence after a sort of epistolary romance, if you will, with a local Providence poet, Sarah Helen Whitman, although she actually had made her reputation in Boston as well. He comes to woo her in part because she's a wonderful poet, but really because she has a fortune that will be left to her, and he's still trying to start his magazine, The Stylus, which he had always wanted to edit.
Sounds like a Poe story.
Yes, indeed. He sees her from a distance. 10 years later, he meets her finally. But they go through this sort of it's really not a very romantic romance. They are connected over a period of months during which her mother figures out immediately what he's after, makes clear she's not in favor of the relationship. They woo at the Athenaeum because they're not really welcome at her mother's home, which is where she lives. So they read there together, read poetry, meet there, and eventually break up there. And the huge scandal is based on the fact that he was seen drinking that morning.
So what does the Providence moment tell you about the man, the whole thing?
Well, he leaves after this fight and this breakup, and he's dead within less than a year. She continues to promote his work for the 30 years remaining in her life. And I think that really is the love part of that love story, because she's tremendously generous about who he was as a man. And when I got to the Athenaeum, I really knew very little about him other than, you know, stuff from fifth grade. And when I began to reread him, because he was part of our history at the library, by this time I had read Henry James and I had read Hawthorne and I had read Melville, and I kept seeing Poe in all of them. And
when I got to the Athenaeum 5-10 years ago, you said you were deep into Poe, and I said, why? Simple, short answer.
Well, I don't know with Poe if there is a simple, short answer. But, I mean, again, I think if you look at the idea of the uncanny, the idea of what's being, you know, in Hawthorne, in James, in Melville, the idea of something other than what is on the page, something other than what is in the room, that constant sense of a sort of dread and a suffocating sense of atmosphere, if you will. You know, I think you take Poe out of the canon, and I don't know where you get that. I mean, maybe, but it seems that, you know, I think I said to you at the time that for someone, for a writer who is often denigrated or thought of as not very good, it's fascinating to see how many very brilliant writers we love who, to me, you know, come directly in some sense from him.
Matthew Pearl, Poe bit you bad for all time. Tell us the story.
Well, like a lot of people, I first read Poe in high school. I actually have my high school copy of Poe right here.
You do? Without
battered
a cover.
And without a cover. And for me, it was a first, which was I was required to read it, but I wanted to keep reading it. This was before I ever thought of being a writer, certainly, before I even considered myself a reader. So that was a unique moment for me. But I think it also represents something unique about Poe, which is that he's still read. That's one of the things that's amazing about him, is that people have an idea of who he was as a person still.
They know what he looks like.
They know what he looks like. People can't pick out of a lineup most of even these 19th century writers who are still read, like Nathaniel Hawthorne.
I was going to say, would I know Longfellow if I met him on the street?
Well, maybe so. Longfellow has that distinctive beard. So in Longfellow's case, it might be the opposite. People might be able to pick him out but not read him. But Poe has this unusual situation
and
where—
And he's the only one we know who's on the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper cover. I mean,
that's
album cover.
That's my first memory, actually, because it was an album that my parents cherished and had the actual their original copy of it. And I remember seeing Poe on that and asking them who several of the people were, including Poe. So that's the interesting thing about Poe, is how much people come to him in popular culture and then have to work backwards to figure out, who is this? Why is he so why is our culture so immersed in Poe?
Who is he to you, Matthew Pearl?
Well, he's changed over time. When you first read him, you have this preconceived idea of this very wild, mysterious, decadent person who was not in control of his life, and some of that comes from reality. But for me, what's been so surprising is to see much more of a human being, someone that had very real aspirations, that was working very hard. He wrote approximately 70 stories, 70 poems. This was someone who died at the age of 40. This was not someone who was just floating through life.
And what's his artistic quest all about for you?
I think bravery, a word that you mentioned earlier, is something that we see in Poe from the very beginning. You know, Poe could have had a much easier life. He could have gone along with John Allan, his foster father, who had a fair amount of money. He could have gone along with his wishes. They didn't get along, and probably Poe was just not built to get along with, well, the truth is to get along with a lot of people, but certainly with John Allan. But he could have made choices in his life that would have made his life much easier. He chose to be a writer. And look, even today, it's not the smartest thing to do to choose to be a writer if you want a stable life, a financial life. But back then, it was almost impossible to make your living as a writer, and yet he did it. That's what he chose to be a writer. He didn't make much of a living, but he continued to pursue that dream of his, and obviously.
Speak to the point that Paul Lewis just began on, his difference with the famous transcendentalists. They thought him immoral. He thought them sort of smugly pious. What's that all about in the stories?
Well, I think one thing that that Paul touched on is that we don't have any moral scheme that we discover in his stories. One scholar said that if you only read Poe, you would never know that Christianity ever existed, and I think that's very incisive.
Interesting point.
It's hard to get any kind of moral trajectory from his stories, and that was again a very brave way of seeing the world, and one that that was asking to challenge readers and asking to be challenged back.
Yeah, it's interesting. Not just no Hollywood endings, but there's no sort of redemptive purpose at work in these stories.
Yeah, I mean, we don't want to generalize, because one thing that is lost by the caricature of Poe is that there is only one or two types of writing that he did. And one of the things you've all spoken about is just the vast array of types of writing that he did, and did very effectively for the most part. His humor stories aren't usually that funny. He's actually funnier when he's not trying to be funny. But other than that, the science fiction, the horror, the mystery, these are genres that for the most part did not exist as categories of writing, and he in many cases crystallized what would become really familiar for us. So in a way, he was taking on the establishment by writing new forms, not just in the ideas that they have.
Paul Lewis, who's the man inside that beautiful statue? And so beautifully unpedestaled, he's just standing there on the bricks. He's charging off. He's off to a case or something. Better looking than a lot of pictures, hairier, better dressed, but who is he?
Well, we really wanted to capture a moment in his life, and specifically to make it site-specific so that it would be about Poe in Boston. And therefore, it's very much angled so that he's walking away from the Frog Pond, walking towards the place where his parents were living around the time that he was born. And he's dismissing them. And the idea is that he's had this lifetime of creative work, and it's so dramatically captured in the statue because that giant raven is flying out of one side of his suitcase and a stack of papers outside the back of it and a heart right on top of those pages. So that, you know, I think that's one of the reasons that people are really enjoying the heck out of the statue. When we got into it, we thought, you know, the raven should take over that Make Way for Duckling site. There should be a raven at the front of those ducklings, you know, or maybe one of those swan boats should be replaced with a raven boat out there on the common. But I think we've made the point more dramatically this way.
But we're still getting to know a man who had the singular misfortune to have a first biography of himself written by his best friend who became his worst enemy. It was a vindictive, poisonous, probably libelous attack. We're still getting, I mean, I'm still trying to see the man inside there. And there are several men. He was, people say, the first in a great line of great American literary drunks. I mean, on to Eugene O'Neill and Faulkner and Hemingway and John Berryman and so many poets. How much should that count?
His relation to alcohol?
Yes.
Well, I think it should count a lot. I mean, this is not something that he, not only that he dealt with in his life, but he dealt with it in his fiction. And the interesting thing to me is that while there's this enormous amount of writing about temperance and intemperance in his time, all of it drenched in didacticism, where it comes up in Poe, for example, in The Black Cat, you have a character who sort of says, well, maybe I murdered my cat and then I murdered my wife because I drank intemperately, or maybe it was the fiend, the imp of the perverse, or maybe it was witchcraft. So instead of writing about these stories of, you know, sort of alcoholism and then redemption through public speaking and that sort of thing, he's using it as a way of intensifying the effect. So I think above all, Poe is trying to have an effect on readers and keeping in mind the idea that he who pleases is of more value to his fellow man than he who instructs.
Christina.
Well, you're asking about the man, and I think in The Black Cat is an example of, you know, the imp of the perverse, and he's this sort of horrible narrator. But at the same time, you know, Poe's humanity sort of spills out in spite of himself. And I was thinking about this last night, that one of the things is that his stories are often, you don't know what time they're set in, what country they're set in. Right. I mean, there's this sort of vagueness. But at the same time, he seems almost always to be writing his story. You know, that early life of so much loss and then an adulthood of such unbelievable poverty. And one of the things that I thought about was how much he has thought, he sort of lives in this dream world, or there are a lot of the stories take place in that dream world. And yet this was a man who, first of all, was a magazine editor, so clearly he, you know, made deadlines and knew what was going on in the world. But also the reality of a life of that kind of poverty where you have no food, no place to sleep, all of, you know, the specifics of physical life are very apparent to him, plus the numbers of deaths that he saw. And so this kind of mix of the very real world, the very real physical world versus this, you know, you can understand why he wanted to live in a different world. But the idea, I think also the idea of a lack of a Christian tradition or whatever, that's a luxury, I think, for somebody who is as desperate and as close to an edge as he always is throughout his life.
Can I just throw something out impromptu and called try it out? As you speak, even as we speak, he reminds me more than I realized of James Joyce. I mean, and not just the drink and the poverty and the desperate driven quality of the work, but there's something relentlessly independent-minded, sort of the non serviam. I'm not here to serve. I'm on my own. I'm confronting the universe naked, putting the church behind him, family, Ireland. He's out there making new form with a tremendous on a tremendous tightrope and at high risk.
Yes.
Is that possible, Paul? That there's a Poe, Joyce. Link?
Well, I wonder whether Joyce would acknowledge some kind of debt to Poe for narrative voice and experimentation, sort of the interior monologue that, you know, they would share. But Poe really was a pioneer in that effort.
Have I stumped the band leader? Matthew
Well,
Pearl.
Just getting back to the alcohol for a second, and I'm probably in the minority of this, but I do think it's a much more complicated issue for Poe. First of all, it's, you know, there had been this tradition, I think it stopped, where someone was leaving a bottle of alcohol on his grave every year on his birthday. I think we deal with the alcohol issue with Poe a little bit ungenerously. You know, he was someone who definitely drank too much at times, but he fought it. He joined temperance societies. He swore to stop. And my reading of the historical documents is that he had a specific problem, which was as soon as he drank one glass. And we don't have the time to argue all the finer points, but that he started to lose control of himself. So I think there's something a little bit more to that.
I don't make much of the drink, you know, as a character issue in either case. But try a few words of Poe and make what you will of them. This is Poe in his own words. As a boy, he had suffered from night fears, and his friend said, "He disliked the dark and was rarely out at night. On one occasion, he said to me, 'I believe that demons take advantage of the night to mislead the unwary, although, you know, I don't believe in them.'" What's the inner spookedness of this man's life, Christina?
Well, I think that there's such a sense of the fragility of life that I think, and also his peripatetic life. You know, he is always one step ahead of whoever he owed money to or whoever just fired him or whoever he just walked out on. And so I think that in some ways there's a sense of him fighting an impending sense of non-existence. Mm. And that kind of overcompensating, maybe, you know, stamping of his foot and declaring his genius, whether anyone is listening or not. Although, you know, as Matthew says, I think we have this view of him being only out of control, et cetera, when in fact he has periods of extreme productivity, great success, you know, as an editor, as a writer. And it's another one of those points of contradiction in his life. He's one thing and then another.
We're talking about Edgar Allan Poe, if you just landed from Mars. The proof of the Poe pudding, of course, is in the prose and the poems. What do we make of all of them, really? I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Here is the actor Basil Rathbone reading Poe's Annabel Lee.
It was many and many a year ago, in a kingdom by the sea, that a maiden there lived whom you may know by the name of Annabel Lee. And this maiden she lived with no other thought than to love and be loved by me. I was a child, and she was a child in this kingdom by the sea. But we loved with a love that was more than love, I and my Annabel Lee.
The measure of the writer in the end is in what he wrote. The poet, story writer, and generally scathing critic and literary theorist, Edgar Allan Poe. So I put it to our guests, Christine Bevilacqua from the Providence Athenaeum, Professor Paul Lewis from Boston College, and the novelist Matthew Pearl from his writing desk in Cambridge. What is your Poe, finally, for the desert island? We'd love to hear it. And the why of your choice? Poe the writer. The proof. Matthew.
Sure. Well, for me, one that I would pick out is a short story called Hop Frog. First of all, because it's one that's not read as much, so it gives us a different window into Poe. And also, it's just a sort of an incredible fantasy about how an underdog can get his revenge on the establishment, which was, of course, a good description of Poe's life.
Christina Bevilacqua.
I'm taking the narrative of Arthur Gordon Pym of Nantucket to an island with me. His only novel, written in 1838, published in 1838, the same year the Athenaeum opens, which is part of my favoriteness of it. But also, it has all of the things you associate with Poe, except for the death of the beautiful woman. But it's also completely not what anybody expects. And also, it goes on. It's not one of the stories that's cut off. Adventure, science, his craziness about race, hoaxes, the inability to tell reality from truth. It pulls from the stories of the day. And again, it's a kind of prequel to Moby Dick. And it's an absolute page turner. You cannot stop until you get to the end. And when you get to the end, you can't believe it's the end.
Paul Lewis.
So I suppose I'd pick The Premature Burial which is an 1844 story, as my favorite, because it moves back and forth between satire and horror, between humor and fear. It's a story about a man who is so afraid that he might go into a catatonic trance and be buried alive that he builds a tomb. And the tomb has a rope that goes down through the ceiling and up to a bell and ties around his hand inside the coffin so that if he is buried alive, he can ring this bell and there's food in the tomb and water in the tomb. And he's completely obsessed with the idea of avoiding premature burial. And then he goes through the experience, despite all those precautions, where he thinks that he has been prematurely buried. Actually, he's just fallen asleep on a barge, which has lots of dirt on it, in a little narrow berth. And it shakes him out of it. And he has this therapeutic response which restores him to a sort of normal sanity. And so the story ends with this unusual for Poe movement away from fear. And yet, even when he's not any longer afraid of premature burial, there's this final paragraph which says, but guess what? Burial is coming. Mm. There are things in this world that are so terrifying that we have to repress knowledge of them. So I think it's a very profound story and a very true one.
We're all going to read them. I would nominate just a few pages at the start of The Murders in the Rue Morgue. He's introducing this fantastic, better than Sherlock, the detective, private guy, Dupin, and he's trying to explain a sort of general theory of analytical reasoning and how a man could leap to unbelievable conclusions about a crime, which of course he does, but the theory of it is all spelled out in a relentless kind of distinguishing of words like observation and imagination and distinctions of understanding, and he's slicing and dicing a sort of process. And in the course of it, there's this very brief reflection that on the differences between skill at chess and checkers and whist or bridge. And the different, you know, he says, as my father used to say to me, I'm just recalling this now, that checkers is a much deeper game than chess. There was a frivolity in chess, a multiplicity of moves that required absolute attention but not profound reflection. Chess was a deeper game, and whist, where you have to observe every mannerism of your partner and the opposition to know exactly where all the cards are after three or four tricks. And there's a repetition of words here that I find wonderful. Or four words. We're talking about a whist player noting every variation of face as the play progresses, gathering a fund of thought from the differences in the expression of certainty, of surprise, of triumph, or chagrin. Combining that with observation of the counting of the tricks, with the order of their arrangement, embarrassment, hesitation, eagerness, or trepidation. In other words, he's giving us it's kind of a brain science of his own head, how the mind works, and who's going to prevail, but how Dupin finally could solve an unsolvable crime without seeing anything. You were saying, Christina, it reminds you of Proust, the sort of drawing of emotional distinctions.
Well, I think also the idea that Proust says the intellect is not really the thing that teaches you or that shows you. And one of the things he says in that section that you just read is what's important is not just the observations, but knowing what to observe.
Exactly.
And it's that difference between intellect and logic versus a kind of intuition. And, you know, I think that's another place where Poe saw himself as, you know, better than most people. He had this kind of skill. You know, there's the great quote, is it or is it not a fact that the heir of democracy agrees better with mere talent than with genius? And he was the genius. And so I think, you know, in a way to not be a man of the crowd and to be alone was in part, his life was very difficult, but it also was sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy because it was about his ability to go into that room, as you just said, and there's nothing there, but he sees everything.
Mm. He was, among other things, a cryptographer and wound that into his stories. I mean, he was a man of many kinds of specialized knowledge. But speak about his psychology. What did he know? What did he decide about the human mind, and how did he get there? Matthew?
Well, you know, I think one thing that he was particularly astute about was the way the human mind worked with belief. He was actually a hoaxer, and much of this was very exaggerated, like his accomplishments as a cryptographer. He built this up. Even the DuPont stories, which are my favorite, DuPont is right because Poe makes him right. It's much more of an accomplishment of Poe as a writer than of DuPont as a thinker, just like Sherlock Holmes as well. If you actually broke down the stories, Sherlock Holmes could just as easily be wrong, and DuPont could just as easily be wrong. So, there was an instance where Poe made the claim that he had predicted the ending of one of Charles Dickens' novels that was being serialized. And, I mean, it was almost completely false. But for decades and decades, scholars just regurgitated this fact that Poe had correctly predicted the ending, which he really hadn't. So one thing that Poe was actually great at was sort of tricking us.
But, Paul, do you have a thought on his understanding of the mind, neuroscience before there was such a thing?
I don't know about neuroscience, but I do think that the idea that you could take control of a reading public and deceive them about something like whether a man dying and on the brink of death can be mesmerized and live for 6 months. If you can fool people of that, then you're assuming the position of controlling the mystery rather than being controlled by it. So I think Poe's instinct to hoax is also a function of his sort of how hot that mystery spot was for him, how many directions it took him into.
You're reminding me of Jonah Lehrer's book that titled Proust Was a Neuroscientist. I think Poe was a neuroscientist, but I'm wondering what his theories were about depression or about goodness or about change in a human character. I mean, do we know? Was he making it up, like the ending of Dickens' novel?
So, I mean, neuroscience in his day was phrenology, and he tended to make fun of it or bring it in as a discredited, superstitious pseudoscience, which it was, even if it is kind of the forebear of neuroscience. It was, in his day, kind of a sham.
Matthew Pearl, you've taken on this amazingly unsolved, not even approached, mystery of how he died. He disappears in Baltimore and then shows up in somebody else's clothes, dead. What's your theory?
Well, you know, it's so interesting with Poe because he was not particularly well known during his life. That's sort of hard to grapple with for us. So in some ways, the biography of Poe starts with his death, not with his birth. In fact, it's only because of people like Paul getting this statue and getting awareness for Poe's connection to Boston that most people would ever even know that Poe was born in Boston. That's not something, if you polled people on the street, that most people would know. So the death is really part of how Poe was formed in the public imagination. And it really was, strangely, a mystery worthy of one of Poe's detective stories. And in part because Poe's stories had such an influence on our culture, we sort of expect that at the end of the story, there is this neat resolution where a figure like DuPont could tell us what happened. And that's not the case. So we'd have to do another show for many hours to go through all the theories. But
we'll do it one night.
The Poe Museum in Richmond, just to give you a sense, this was a couple years ago. I don't know if they still have this exhibit, but had a death exhibit with cubes that you spin. And on each side of the cube is a different theory of his death. Rabies, which was absurd.
Try him out. I mean, I've heard that he had a brain seizure or a stroke. I've heard that he was made helplessly drunk to get around to polling places so that he could change an election. I mean,
this was called cooping. There's a couple murder theories, robbery. I mean, I would use the time for my own little theory, which is
I'm dying to hear it.
Well, you know, I was so intrigued by this that I wrote a novel about a character trying to solve Poe's death. Someone who was a big fan of Poe's when Poe dies, which would have almost been non-existent. And while I was touring with the book, I kept getting the question, well, why don't we just exhume Poe's body? With today's science, we could just test it and see what was going on. And I mean, it's sort of a comical question. Of course, they're not going to dig up the memorial above Poe's grave. But it made me remember, well, you know what? Poe's body was exhumed. It was moved from one part of the cemetery to the other about 25 years after his death. And I looked back at my material, and I found at least two newspaper articles that detailed what was seen in the coffin when it was moved. And both talked about the brain in the skull shrunken into a hardened globe, a miniature brain, essentially. And I contacted a friend of mine who was a coroner, and I said, you know, does this make any sense to you? And she helped me realize that, I don't know this, I'm not a forensic scientist, the brain is the first thing to liquefy. But if you had a brain tumor, it could calcify and harden and look like sort of a mini brain and still be there 25 years later. So that led me to think, you know, this might be one of our only pieces of actual physical evidence. And, you know, it would sort of make sense. A brain tumor can cause disinhibited behavior. It can even resemble being drunk. It could certainly cause confusion. And even a brain tumor that would be harmless today because of our treatments could be deadly back then. So it's one option.
Christina, Paul, review it. Kick it. Test it.
I think it's so fascinating that people care about how Poe died. And it's a sense of this rich afterlife and also the fact that he's drawn such a large popular audience. So there's a kind of fascination. This is the first generation of American writers that created a brand for themselves, a really public identity that they could then commercialize. Poe was terrible at commercializing it, but he was pretty good at projecting that image of himself as the tortured romantic artist, you know, in poverty and in disgrace and in controversy, and then that this would have kicked up with his death is just fascinating.
Christina, does that solve a mystery for you or not?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know that I've thought. I mean, I have thought about how he died, but more, I guess, one of the things that I think about a lot is because he dies so young, he's one of those writers that should have been around longer. And so I'm always thinking, you know, he should have lived into when his contemporaries died. And so you think, what would it have been like? I mean, given it's actually amazing how much he did in the life that he had, given sort of all the constraints against him. And you think, what would the 19th century have been like with another 40 years of Poe? So, you know, how he actually physically died, I guess I don't think as much about it, but I do think about what it meant for what didn't come after.
An undiagnosed brain tumor does explain great confusion, disappearances, seizures, falling down, being taken for drunk, all sorts of things. Doesn't explain how he got into somebody else's clothes, though.
Well, there's a couple options on that. He could have just bought clothes that were too big for him. But in any case, none of these things have one explanation that's part of why it's so intriguing and why we keep talking about it.
This makes me want to talk on and on about him. It makes me long to hear him read aloud on the radio or by a fireplace or whatnot. The stories that I've been reading, 15 of them maybe since in the last couple of weeks, are astonishingly good. I'm just so grateful for the revival, and we'll do what we can to keep it going. Thank you to Paul Lewis, Christina Bevilacqua, and Matthew Pearl. Thanks also to Nick Mamatis and Pat Bartavian. You can hear them on our website. You'll find every work that was mentioned in the program and more Poe-related images, sounds, and video on our website, radioopensource.org. There's an essential guide to 5 hidden treasures in the Poe canon, just in time for Halloween. And if you're looking for more, you can stop in and see a new bust unveiled tonight at the Boston Public Library, or you can go out on Paul Lewis's renowned tour of Poe's Boston. We're going out on one of the innumerable recordings of Poe's The Raven. This one is from The Simpsons. The unmistakable voice here is James Earl Jones. He was introduced by Lisa Simpson.
He's called the Raven. Once upon a midnight dreary,
while I pondered weak and weary over many a quaint and curious volume of forgotten lore, while I nodded, nearly napping, suddenly there came a tapping. As of someone gently rapping at my chamber door.
"'Tis some visitor,"
I muttered.
"'Tapping at my chamber door. Only this and nothing.
more.
Are we scared yet?
Bart, he's establishing mood.
Ah, distinctly I remember. It was in the bleak December, and each separate dying ember wrought its ghost upon the floor. Eagerly I wished the morrow. Vainly I had sought to borrow from my books surcease of sorrow. Sorrow for the lost Lenore.
Oh, Lenore.
For the rare and radiant maiden whom the angels name Lenore, nameless here forevermore.
Our show was produced by Max Larkin and Connor Gillies, with help from Rebecca Panovka and MJ Fabre. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our raven. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time for Open Source.